December 10th, 1974. A truce between the British government and the Provisional IRA was on a knife's edge. The Loyalist paramilitary groups, the UVF and the UDA, were watchful and suspicious. The British Army was waiting for the Provisionals to back out of the ceasefire and take up their guns. Everybody was watching and waiting to see if the fragile peace would collapse and plunge Northern Ireland into civil war. This episode will focus on the smaller Republican paramilitary group, the Irish Nationalist Liberation Army, otherwise known as the INLA, and the man at their forefront, Seamus Costello, who wanted to create an Irish socialist revolution, but in the process, he ended up getting sucked into a war against fellow Republicans, which would end up taking the ultimate toll. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. It's the evening of December 10th, 1974, and nearly 80 Republicans are gathered in the Spa Hotel in Dublin. The bare walls were plastered with posters depicting the Easter Rising, James Connolly, the Starry Plough, and the Hammer and Sickle of Communism. Of those gathered were an amalgamation of Republicans, Socialists, Marxist members of the Connolly Association, former official IRA members, and a small number of Sinn Féin members. They were seated, watching one man speak passionately from a podium, a man that claimed that in the nationalist struggle for a free Ireland, that the class struggle was being forgotten. That Ireland had forgotten that you cannot fight the nationalist battle without also fighting the class war. The man speaking was Seamus Costello, 35 years of age, with dark features and slick back hair. Born in the Irish county of Wicklow in 1939, Costello grew up in modest circumstances. At the age of 16, he joined the IRA. After 2 years at the age of just 18, he was commander of an active service unit operating in County Derry as part of the IRA's 1950 border campaign. This was before the IRA split into two. This campaign ran from the 12th of December 1956 to the 26th of February 1962 and was a guerrilla campaign launched against the British presence in Northern Ireland and the Royal Ulster Constabulary. There were bombings, assassinations, and over 400 Republicans interned in the Republic. Though many Republicans claimed the campaign was a success, it would lead to another generation of Irish taking up arms, and some have said that it achieved nothing and fizzled out. Or in the words of the former head of the Provisional IRA's intelligence, Kieran Conway, quote, "That campaign was a complete fucking disaster." During the campaign, Costello became apt at the destruction of bridges, earning himself the nickname the Boy General, and he quickly earned the respect of others. Costello was later interned at the Curragh prison in 1957, and it was there that he became more politically aware of the ideology of Irish Republicans and the teaching of Wolfe Tone, Pierce and Connolly. Ultimately, though, it was the teachings of Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong that influenced him the most, as he read of the socialist struggle against the imperial forces and the guerrilla tactics of the North Vietnamese army against US Marines in the jungles. Costello felt that this was the way to beat the imperial British that were occupying Ireland, to fight the war using guerrilla tactics and win the hearts and minds of the public in a socialist struggle was the only way forward. By the time Costello left jail, he had become a high-ranking member of the IRA. However, the border campaign had come to an end, so he resumed civilian life and began earning a living as a car salesman. He was charming and articulate, and this came easy to him. It wasn't long, though, before the Troubles kicked off in 1969. As a result of this, he rejoined Sinn Féin, aka the political wing of the IRA. It's important here to understand the difference between the original IRA and the Provisional IRA, who had not yet emerged. In 1969, when the Troubles began, the official IRA was split in two because of two important issues. The first being that many members felt that the Dublin-based officials had failed to protect the Catholics of the North that were being terrorised by a sectarian police force, the B Specials, and the RUC. The second reason was that many believed that the official IRA had lost its nerve in the North and wouldn't challenge the new British presence. So in January 1970, at an ardfesh, which is an Irish word for a political meeting, up to 50 Republicans walked out in disgust and set about forming a new council. These were the men who would form what would eventually become the Provisional IRA. This council included Seamus Tooney, Ivor Bell, Dahi O'Connell, Des Long, Sean McStephan, and Martin McGuinness. In the words of Sean, they wanted to, quote, "escalate, escalate, escalate" against the British forces in Northern Ireland. But to Costello, the Provisionals had no mindset or vision for a war against the capitalists or imperialists. So he remained with the official IRA for now. Fast forward to 1974, and Costello was disgusted with the ceasefire that had been brokered by the Provisionals. whom many of his comrades called rosary bead men with zero political ideology. He was also unhappy with the official IRA leadership under Cathal Goulding, who felt they were being led by the nose by the provisionals and that the ceasefire was barely holding together. As a result of these views, Costello was court-martialed by the IRA at the start of 1974 and barred from taking part in the Sinn Féin elections. He then decided to go his own way and make his own party. In that winter of 1974, Costello was in the halls of the Spa Hotel and making a decision that would define his life. He was breaking away from the original IRA and his friend Cathal Goulding and forming a new political party, a real left-wing party, the Irish Republican Socialist Party, or IRSP. This party would take up the philosophies of Connolly, Marx, Che Guevara and Trotsky and join other anti-imperialist forces that were fighting imperialism across the globe. They would challenge the British imperial war machine at the ballot box, both north and south of the border, to bring about a 32-county socialist republic. 5 days later, Costello would chair the first IRSP conference, with its demands that Britain must immediately give up all claim on Ireland, her land, waters and her political affairs, and all forces of the Crown must return to their barracks and depart Ireland. As well as that, all prisoners of the Crown, both in Long Kesh and the Maze, must be released. Many members of this new party were hopeful and believed that the IRSP would achieve what Sinn Féin had failed to do. Costello was happy. He had a new party with over 100 members, full of energy, ready to lead a revolution. But what he didn't know is that instead of going to lead Ireland and Northern Ireland to a glorious revolution, his party would be sucked into a vortex of feuding, sectarian murder and bombings that would leave many nationalists dead on the streets of Belfast. So on the surface, we have the setting up of the IRSP. But behind the scenes, there was something else happening. Many of those who showed up at the hotel had no interest in a political means to accomplishing their goals. Amongst those present were disgruntled provisional IRA and original IRA paramilitary members. Behind the scenes, we were witnessing the formation of a new paramilitary group, one that would fight the British war machine and, more importantly, strike back at the loyalists who had in that year committed over 30 Catholic murders. This paramilitary group was given the name the Irish National Liberation Army, or INLA. They'd acquired money through bank robberies in the Republic in Dublin and Limerick, but what they needed now was guns. They had some pistols and shotguns, but they needed carbines, machine guns, and lots of them. Initially, Costello wanted to keep this wing secret because the INLA were not ready yet to attack the British forces, nor were they ready to take a war to the Loyalists. But whispers had gotten out through the streets of Belfast and Dublin that, quote, a new organisation was up and running and ready to fight the Brits. Word had even gotten to the prisoners and the cages of H-Block at Maze Prison. Costello did his best to keep the INLA a secret in the early stages, because he knew that they would be vulnerable to the threat of the British Army and the Loyalists, but he didn't think to look at another potential threat. The real threat to the INLA would not come from the hands of the British troops, nor would it come from the Loyalists in Shankill or the Ardoyne. What Costello didn't realise is that the greatest danger came from an organisation much closer to home, the IRA, and they were watching Costello and his INLA very closely. Now, before we go any further, we have to understand that the problem that plagued Irish republicanism during the Troubles was fragmentalisation and subgroups within a broad front, each competing to be the face of the movement. This wasn't a new problem. Historically, revolutions have a tendency to splinter and turn upon one another. After the Russian Revolution of 1917, the Trotskyites turning against the Mensheviks and the Mensheviks being persecuted by the Bolsheviks. It was also seen in Ireland when Michael Collins was killed by his fellow Irish people during the Irish Civil War. We also see the splintering during the Troubles, when the Ulster Freedom Fighters would erupt into a bloody feud against the Loyalist Volunteer Force. When it comes to the Troubles and the concept of Irish republicanism, little is often mentioned of the eternal conflicts that went on under the umbrella of republicanism. But in that winter of 1974, Irish republicanism about to embrace a new bloody feud. Since Seamus Costello proclaimed this party and its military wing, it was the official IRA, not the provisionals, who were most disturbed and angered. Because ever since the provisionals split, many of the leading official IRA members, such as Cathal Goulding, Billy McMillan and Sean Garland, were angered by the split and the creation of the provisionals. For the sake of brevity, from now on I'm just going to call them the provos and the officials. They believed it weakened Irish republicanism and that they, the officials, were the true republicans. Yet they still kept their distance between the provos. By 1974, the provos were very powerful, with figures in their ranks such as Martin McGuinness, Seamus Toomey, Dahi O'Connell and Brendan Hughes. The officials knew that they were too powerful to stop. This split from the officials was humiliating for the old guard of republicanism. So they weren't going to allow it to happen a second time, and least of all not to what they perceived as left-wing upstarts. The first warning flashes came when the officials in the middle of December discovered that many of their members were defecting to the IRSP and the INLA, and they were losing members in Newry, Dundalk and Antrim. During research for this episode, I reached out to representatives from this party, and one explained that the IRSP held their meetings in the Ardoyne area of Belfast, as it was the only area where the entirety of the officials' unit moved to the IRSP. Official leaders published press leaflets, rebuffing some claims, and saying that they were not concerned about dead wood that left their party. They had witnessed the fate of what befell those who tried to do it in the past, and they weren't concerned about this new small party. Paul Tinley was one such individual who had defected from the officials and tried to form his own Tinley Brigade, styling himself on the teachings of Che Guevara. This didn't end well for Tinley, as he would eventually be riddled with bullets in front of his wife in 1974 at the hands of the officials. Costello at this point was not worried, but many of his colleagues in hindsight felt he was being overconfident. He felt like this split would be similar to the split of 1969, which saw the formation of the Provos. It was bloodless and dialogue prevailed. Costello thought the same would happen again, but he couldn't have been more wrong. His confidence wasn't without reason. In his ranks and party, he now had some powerful figures, including Ronnie Bunting, the son of Ian Paisley's right-hand man, Major Bunting. Bunting was a revolutionary Protestant who wanted to take the fight to the imperialists. There was also the dangerous and sinister Gerard Steenson, seasoned Republicans Frank Gallagher and Vinty Fagan, Michael Plunkett, Miriam Daly, and lastly, Bernadette Devlin, who gave the party a gravitas and a pull that other organisations couldn't ignore. By January of 1975, two representatives from the prisoners of Longkesh came forward and claimed that the IRSP and INLA wing had formed in the cages, claiming that the old days of the officials were over and that they hated the elitist nationalism of the provisionals. They claimed the way forward was with the INLA and a socialist struggle. A second representative came forward from the officials within the prison, claiming that they would stand by the officials and would have nothing to do with these fanatical Trotskyites. This was a glaring symbol that division and tensions were not confined to the streets, but it also reached the prisons. From the perspective of the officials, the INLA were now worryingly making headway with their membership, and now there had been desertions from the officials in places that had been strongholds, such as the Markets, the Ardoyne, and Twinbrook. But the most worrying of all was Divis Flats. The Divis Flats, which lay at the foot of the Falls Road, was once called the Citadel of the Stickies, Stickies being a colloquial word for the official IRA. And rumours soon reached the ears of the original's leader, Cathal Goulding, that members in Divis were considering joining the INLA. He immediately sent a high-ranking officials member as an ambassador from Dublin to the Divis Flats to call a meeting with the local official battalion. It couldn't have gone worse. And one officials man said in 1993, it was a fucking disaster. The officials man threatened and lambasted the unit and warned them that if their allegiance swayed, there would be consequences. Quote, he humiliated them. Voices were raised, and in the end, the battalion all defected and went over to the INLA. This battalion left the officials and left Divis, and took all their guns with them. So why was the relationship between the officials and the INLA nosediving at such a speed? Well, first we have to understand how and why the officials viewed the INLA as they did. As I've said before, the officials didn't want to be humiliated a second time, but there was more to that. The officials were under pressure to show support for socialism and the working classes of Northern Ireland. But they claimed that the INLA were following doctrine from left-wing fascists in Europe and South America. The officials claimed that they had all the inspiration they needed from the green Republicans of Pierce, Connolly and Wolfetone, not what they called the red raving of Stalinists and Mao zealots. There was another far more serious reason for them wanting to challenge the INLA, and that was sectarianism. Some provisionals didn't like how many of their members simply hated Protestants, as opposed to the security forces. This was made glaringly clear in 2019 when Des Long, who was one of the chief of staff of the Provisionals, recounted in an interview with journalist Dara McIntyre that he was stunned by the blatant sectarianism of his recruits. In one example, when conducting a weapons class in Dublin in the 70s, one of the new recruits held a rifle and said to Des, I can't wait to start giving it to the Blue Noses with this. Blue Nose? Des asked, mystified. Yeah, the prods. Des snatched the rifle from the recruit and said angrily, we'll have none of that. We're here to fight forces of the Crown. Things came to a head between the INLA and the officials in February 1975. The officials had begun dismissing the INLA in their pamphlets as simply a useless protest group that could be found on any university campus. Yet when the name of some of the defectors became too serious to ignore, the officials now called the INLA an amalgamation of left-wing radicals bank robbers, and gangsters. It was now openly warning Republicans of the dangers of this group. Some say this was a slur campaign against the INLA to smear their name, and some claim that the mudslinging of the INLA was the officials laying the PR groundwork so that when the bodies did start hitting the floor, and they would very shortly, the officials would have the high ground in the eye of their fellow Republicans. The first signs of violence emerged in early February 1975 when an IRSP representative went to the Northern Irish Press and claimed several of their members had been kneecapped for being a part of this group. For anyone who doesn't know, kneecapping is when you're shot in the back of the knee, which is not lethal, but it will affect you for the rest of your life. One INLA man claimed that officials burst into his home in Derry and dragged him away to be severely beaten. He claimed that he was told by the gang, quote, "Nip this fucking group in the bud, or we'll nip you in the bud." Later that month in North Belfast, at a pub called the Gem Bar, the IRSP were holding a meeting, when suddenly the door opened and an official's commanding officer walked in flanked by two others. He declared the meeting was over and for everyone to leave. When one of the IRSP members tried to stand up and argue with the men, he was then viciously pistol-whipped in front of horrified onlookers. Many IRSP members were claiming that the officials were trying to beat and intimidate them out of existence. The response to these accusations by the officials was chilling. They sternly responded in the media that their reasons for their actions against these individuals were because they were involved in gangsterism and antisocial behaviour. They claimed that those whom they attacked were conducting themselves in a way to intimidate working class people of these districts and using the umbrella of a political group as a disguise and protection. They finished with a menacing warning saying, "All measures will be taken to stamp out any antisocial or criminal activity." Many in the IRSP were claiming that the officials had made a formal declaration to annihilate the IRSP and the INLA. Cathal Goulding claims in an interview in 1993 that he wanted nothing of the sort. Quote, "I just wanted the IRSP and the INLA to go their way and we'd go ours." Costello revealed the existence of the INLA in February 1975, and some have said that he did so too soon while they were small and lacked the guns to protect themselves from other Republicans. Costello went one step further and claimed that the officials had drawn upon a death list of prominent INLA members. This accusation was made after two men wearing balaclavas and carrying pistols stood outside the home of INLA man Ronnie Bunting and fired their guns into his house, nearly killing his wife. Then, INLA commander Vinty Fagan was shot at by masked gunmen, narrowly missing him. Many now suspected that the officials were determined to wipe out this fledgling group. Costello found himself backed into a corner. Many INLA gunmen were complaining to him that they lacked the proper firepower to defend themselves against the officials. As well as that, the press were accusing him of having an armed and dangerous wing of the IRSP, to which he was denying at every turn. "The IRSP has no armed wing," he would angrily claim. "They are a strictly political party." But as author Jonathan Holland pointed out, Costello was now tongue-tied in dealing with journalists, because if the IRSP was purely political and didn't have an armed wing, then why were well-known and dangerous former provosts and official paramilitary members joining them? These new members were claiming that their former parties were not militant enough and that they were unhappy with the ceasefire. It just didn't make sense. And Costello knew it. So I've explained why the officials joined the INLA, but what about the provos? Many provos who joined the INLA felt that the provos were too focused on the nationalist struggle and willing to fight the British, but had no notion or interest in a socialist struggle or waging a class war. They believed that the Provisional IRA had become too nationalistic and elitist. By now, the loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force, had taken notice, claiming in their paramilitary newspaper, quote, that a new nationalist organisation, basing itself on the guerrilla tactics of Che Guevara and Castro, was now stalking the streets of Shankill and Portadown, ready to destroy the Protestant way of life. For Costello, this was the last thing he needed. Many within the ranks of the INLA were shocked that the UVF was aware of them, as they were still quite small in size. This led some to suspect that the officials were drip-feeding information to the loyalists. On the 20th of February 1975, on a cold Thursday afternoon, Hugh Ferguson was standing at the forecourt of a building site on White Rock Road in Belfast. Ferguson was 19 years old and the chairman of the IRSP branch of White Rock, earning himself the nickname King of the Rock. Although only 19, Ferguson was known to be very tough and, in the words of one IRSP member, game for anyone. He had been an OC for the officials but had defected to the INLA in the previous year. Ferguson's reputation was well known throughout the area and he was respected across the board. That previous month in January, his younger brother, Michael, had been shot at by a passing car full of officials' men, the bullets narrowly missing him. Upon hearing of this attempted assassination, Hugh armed himself, and that night he went to an official stronghold and warned the OC of that unit, if anything happens to his brother, he would personally deal with them. The officials were under no illusion what kind of man Hugh was. Apparently, due to this threat and such a tough member of the officials defecting to the INLA, the officials had to teach him a lesson. Just a heads up that the following account has been disputed by many members of the officials and the INLA. Hugh was working on a building site when a car parked on the opposite side of the road. The car was filled with three officials' men, and they got out of the car and walked towards Hugh. Some witnesses said that there was a lot of shouting and effing and blinding. But whatever the case, shots rang out. Ferguson fell to the floor, bleeding after being shot in the torso and neck. An ambulance screeched into White Rock Road as pedestrians gathered. He was declared dead in the ambulance. Ferguson has the unfortunate title of being the first casualty of the feud, but he would not be the last. To this day, the officials deny that they intended to kill Hughes, and one IRA man said to a journalist in 1994, quote, "Look, it was basically a kneecapping gone wrong. He fought back and he was shot. He wasn't meant to die." In the immediate wake of this killing, the IRSP issued a statement saying that this was an execution committed by the officials and that Hugh's comrades wanted instant revenge. Costello forbade any retaliation until a full inquiry was launched. The officials still strongly deny that the killing of Hughes was intentional, and one official's Belfast commander claimed that the gunman who killed Hughes was distraught at what happened and still is to this day. The INLA were now in a precarious situation, as one of their own had been gunned down, but their leader was still hesitant to retaliate. This, in turn, was because, in Costello's mind, they were still too small to take on the officials. Costello was getting pressure from all sides. His men were angry and out for blood. His party was in its infancy and taking pressure from the media. And to top it all off, loyalist paramilitaries had embarked on another killing spree. By the time Hugh Ferguson was laid to rest, five Catholics had been murdered in random sectarian murders. On the day after Hugh's funeral, a Catholic factory worker named David McConkie was working when a masked gunman came into his factory and told him to get on his knees and, in front of his fellow workers, shot him in the head. The UVF later took credit for this murder. Costello was warned by one of his INLA chieftains that the men were itching to retaliate at the officials, the British, and the loyalists. Costello told everyone to wait. What happened next was a clear sign that Costello might have been in control over the IRSP party in Bray, County Wicklow, but he had no control over his men in Belfast and Derry. The very night after Hugh's funeral, a car full of INLA men, ignoring the orders of Costello, went out and firebombed the official's HQ building and then an official pub. Then hours later, they burst into the home of an official's member, who was allegedly the driver of the hit team that killed Hugh and shotgunned him in the legs. The officials swiftly issued a warning, saying they had teams crawling Belfast looking for these attackers. But the INLA wasn't finished. To show just how much they meant business, they paid for a eulogies and condolences page in the Irish Times for over a dozen dead officials' men expressing their sadness. However, all the men named were alive. For now. In the days since Hugh's death, the clatter of guns reverberated through Belfast. Homes were firebombed and pubs were shot at. The real sign that the INLA was a force to be reckoned with came 5 days after the killing of Hughes. It was February 25th, and three officials' men were walking towards the Divis Flats. These men were Sean Fox, Eamon the Hatchet Kerr, and a third man who must remain unnamed. The three men had just left their car when they were spotted by INLA member Danny Loughran, who was standing some 200 yards away in an entryway. Loughran, like Hughes, was 19 years old and hiding out in Belfast from the Irish Army in the Republic, from which he went AWOL. Loughran was allegedly a sharpshooter for the Army and was a vital asset to the INLA. It is unclear if Loughran was acting under orders or not, but whatever the case, after seeing the three men, he ran quickly and grabbed a carbine rifle, shouldered it, aimed and fired a dozen rounds at the men. The three men dived for cover, car alarms sounded as windows smashed, and Sean Fox slumped dead to the ground, hit in the head and the neck. Fox was 32 years of age and he had five children. He was an official since the Battle of the Bogside and considered a high-class member, taking part in numerous battles against British troops and RUC men. He was dragged away by his friends who were unharmed and rushed to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. In the 2 hours that followed, two more officials would be wounded by gunshots and then an INLA pub would be firebombed. The violence grew so intense that Merlin Rees, who was the Secretary of State, was conducting a visit to the Belfast police station just a mile from where Fox was killed to show, quote, just how well the ceasefire was upholding. when he was suddenly forced to abandon plans, and armed RUC and British troops escorted him quickly out of the area, whilst the noise of gunfire was in the background. In the wake of the death of Sean Fox, the official response was as chilling as it was blandly formal. They stated in the Irish Times, quote, "Simply put, we are now in a vicious and open war. We know who you are. Retaliation shall be forthcoming, and unfortunately, many more have yet to die before this is resolved." The INLA, now believing a bloody retaliation was imminent, decided to try and strike first. 4 days after Fox's funeral, four INLA men were in a car, armed with pistols and a list of names, heading to Dublin. On this list were the names of high-ranking officials, Cathal Goulding, Desi O'Hagan and Sean Garland. The next day when they reached Dublin, their targets O'Hagan and Goulding couldn't be located, so they drove back to Belfast. However, being urged not to give up, a week later they drove south into the Republic, but this time not to South Dublin but to Ballymun, to find and attempt to kill officials member Sean Garland. Many considered this a risky move. Sean Garland was a highly feared officials member and a notorious hard man. This was due to his reputation and experience in gun battles and ambushes against the RUC in the 1950s border campaign. On the night of March 1, 1975, a team of armed INLA gunmen drove to Ballymun and onto Balcarras Road where Garland lived. Garland was returning from a birthday party with his wife. As they were leaving their parked car and walking up the pathway to their house, three hooded gunmen jumped out of the shadows and fired a volley of shots. Garland was struck 6 times in the stomach and legs and collapsed on the ground, while his wife dived for cover and the gunmen ran off to their car and screeched off. To the amazement of everyone, Garland survived his wounds. But this was a watershed moment for the INLA, and it was a glaring symbol of the weakness of Costello in controlling their northern element. The Belfast squads had acted upon their own accord and didn't seek his permission. When Costello heard that Garland had been wounded in an attempted hit, he was furious. Garland was an old comrade in arms to Costello, and despite their differences, he didn't want this. From his home in Wicklow, he called a colleague in Belfast and angrily demanded who gave the order to carry out such an attack, to which the Belfast INLA man coldly replied, "We did." To be fair to Costello, this wasn't a problem that was unique to the INLA alone. During the Troubles, Irish republicanism had been plagued by this north-south divide, and Costello was learning a harsh lesson that the officials learned with the formation of the Provos, in that it's easy to issue orders and attend rallies and speak about the war effort in Dublin, but it's a different story when you're trying to tell men how to fight in the sectarian streets of Belfast and Derry. The situation was probably rounded up best by the commanding officer of the Provos, Brendan Hughes, who in an interview with a journalist in the year 2000 stated that the direction of the struggle was always given by men with Southern Irish accents. Quote, "Those fucking Dahi O'Connells and Rory O'Braddicks, down in their 26 counties, they didn't know the reality of the show up north." Costello was just the latest to learn the hard truths about trying to control Belfast. After the shooting of Garland, the violence in Belfast quickly escalated. One IRSP member claimed that the city had turned into a kidnapping and kneecapping factory. The day after Garland's attempted murder, an IRSP member was beaten unconscious in the street with a bat, and an official's pub in the markets was firebombed. The INLA Protestant gunman, Robbie Bunting, was once again targeted. As he was leaving his home, a masked rifleman sprayed him with bullets and then ran away. A bullet pierced Bunting's neck, but missed his vital arteries. And Bunting stunned doctors when he drove himself to the Victoria Hospital with his neck wound. So great was the violence that a women's group from the Turf Lodge issued a plea as representatives of the Catholic communities of Belfast to desist in the violence for the sake of everyone, yet neither side was finished, and Sean Fox had still to be avenged by his officials' comrades. However, the urgency continued as people were trying to form a ceasefire between the warring sides. A priest was brought in to bring the two sides to the table. The priest was Father Des Wilson. He was a friend of Costello and, in the eyes of many Republicans, a man of great calibre, and had a solid reputation as an honest broker. Father Wilson was motivated to bring the ceasefire about as the violence in Belfast had grown unpalatable to many elements on both sides. Yet again, Costello now found himself in between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, his constant denial that the INLA didn't exist and the IRSP did not have a military wing, which it most definitely did. This injured his ability to negotiate with the officials. When he told the officials, through Father Wilson, that he and some of his INLA men would be willing to meet with them and deliberate peace, the officials replied in an almost sarcastic manner. They said, "Why would we want to meet and discuss peace with people that don't exist?" Another problem was that the Loyalists had now set their sights on the INLA, and Costello knew that he couldn't fight on two fronts, against Loyalists and Republicans. The Loyalists took action against the INLA on Saturday the 8th of March, when Michael Adamson, a 23-year-old Catholic, was with his young wife preparing to go to his brother's wedding outside the city. His wife spotted two men in clawhammer tuxedos and corsages in their lapels, carrying flowers and walking down their garden path towards their home. They then rang the doorbell. When Adamson answered the door, two men pulled out pistols and executed him on the spot. The UVF later claimed that his killing was perpetrated because Adamson was not only a Catholic, but a dangerous Leninist and a member of an ultra-red nationalist group. The IRSP denied his membership, although it was noted by the IRSP that he had attended their rallies. By March 19, 1975, the mediations of Father Wilson were proving to be somewhat successful. Costello once again showed his willingness to embark on peace talks, and Goulding had spoken to the women's group at the Turf Lodge, assuring them everything was being done to desist the violence. As a result, there was a brief respite in the violence and shootings, though the city was tense. Letters were then passed between Costello and the officials, each listing their demands. Costello demanded to speak with Goulding, who was the commander of the official IRA, and also the recently wounded Sean Garland, but he was refused. The officials demanded all of the names of the combatants of the INLA, but Costello once again refused to admit their existence. Despite this impasse between the two demands, the clashes seemed to be only verbal, and the attacks in the streets slowly lessened, much to the relief of the residents of Belfast. On April the 3rd, the IRSP and the officials held a meeting. 40 IRSP gunmen were forced to stand down, and many resumed solely political activities. But this was not to last. After a week, the tit-for-tat shooting started to build up in a crescendo, much to the shock and anger of Father Des Wilson. It seems that many of Sean Fox's comrades still wanted to avenge him. They set their sights on his alleged killer, Danny Loughran. On April the 5th, as Danny was walking home from the pub, two men leapt out of an entry wearing balaclavas and shot him dead. The response of the INLA was swift. 24 hours later, officials chief Desi O'Hagan was shotgunned and severely wounded. At the funeral of Danny Loughran, all pretense of the IRSP not having a paramilitary wing was abandoned. He received a full paramilitary send-off, with his coffin draped with the Starry Plough, and men stood in a guard of honour, wearing black berets and sunglasses, as three masked men fired a volley of shots over his coffin. This show of force was the INLA showing themselves to the world, and more importantly, to their enemies. A week after the funeral and full military display of Loughran's service, Father Wilson threatened to give up his role as a broker, but Costello pleaded with him to preserve. During the week of Loughran's funeral, a man by the name of Paul Crawford was killed outside officials' headquarters. He had no significant role in the organisation, but was simply selling pamphlets endorsing Sinn Féin. He, like so many others of Violence in the Troubles, was just in the wrong place at the worst possible time. This killing created more tension at a vital time, as Father Des Wilson was trying to arrange peace talks between the two groups. Fighting had now also erupted up in Derry. Up until this point, the gunfire exchanged between the two groups was exclusively in Belfast, but now there were shootings in the Creggan estate between the INLA and the officials. In a moment of near desperation, Costello published an open letter to say that there were demands and willingness for there to be peace between the two organisations. He knew the local elections were coming up, and all the energies of the party would be needed to win seats, yet something was about to happen that would ultimately seal his fate. As Costello was campaigning for a peaceful resolution, the violence continued. On the 28th of April 1975, officials commander Billy McMillan had parked his van on a curb outside a maintenance shop near the Falls Road. He got out of the van and walked hand in hand into the shop with his young wife. They had only been married for 3 months. Unbeknownst to him, a black taxi had slowed to a crawl and parked opposite the road. Inside the taxi was a short 16-year-old teenager, Jared Steenson, who would later earn the nickname Dr. Death. Steenson was a highly determined and committed gunman of the INLA and would ultimately be shot dead many years later. In the taxi also with him was his friend and fellow member, Brendan McNamee, who had a revolver pointed at the taxi driver's head. It would seem that they had hijacked the taxi and were passing by the area when they spotted McMillan. No one knows if they intentionally set out to do what they did that day, or if they just saw McMillan in passing, but it was an opportunity that he wouldn't let pass. McMillan had just paid for a pack of iron nails, and him and his wife were walking out of the shop and were getting into the van when four shots rang out, and he fell to the pavement, with his feet still inside the van, He had been shot in the throat. One eyewitness described the scene, saying his wife stood over him screaming while he was trying to breathe, but his throat caved in and he died. The woman who served Macmillan in the shop recalled a grim show of how numb the city had become to the violence of the Troubles. She recalls that a woman made her way through the crowd, ignoring Macmillan's body, stuck her head in the shop and asked, "Do you have any wallpaper?" This was the fateful blow that sealed Costello's fate. One of his friends, Tony Hayde, was present when he heard the news of Macmillan's murder. They were in a house in Dublin when they got the news, and Costello went white, silent. He turned to Hayde and said, "Well, there it is, Tony. That's my death warrant." Costello knew that by the INLA taking out such a high-profile figure of the officials, they would want blood and would want to strike at the leadership. No more young foot soldiers of Belfast and Derry. The officials would want him. The city now braced itself for a new scale of violence, yet it never materialised. Some suggest that the officials had realised that they had wasted precious energy in stomping out this new group, and in truth, the officials released a blunt and simple message after this assassination. Quote, "We know who is behind this, and we will pursue them to the very ends of the earth." The officials had concluded that no more time and energy must be wasted in tit-for-tat reprisals. The people that made this party had to go. And simply put, Costello had to die. They just needed to wait and strike at the right time. Whilst many Republicans and officials would mourn Macmillan, a man that seemed to embody the old guard of republicanism, many of his enemies couldn't hide their joy. In one incident in Lancash, when the news had been broken to the INLA prisoners that Macmillan was dead, a great cheer went up from the men, and many ran up to the bars and shouted insults at the officials' men that were locked up in the opposite cage. Quote, "Billy, what about Billy? Oh, your poor Billy, what happened to your man?" After the death of Macmillan, a semblance of truce was struck between the officials and the INLA. The officials had suffered a mortal wound, and its hold on Belfast through Macmillan's death was weakened. But they were an old organisation, and if they had learned one skill over the decades, it was patience. Costello, confident that the worst of the IRA-INLA conflict was over, was now fully engaged on a new political campaign of politics and paramilitary activity. Over the next 2 years, the INLA would battle with the UVF and with British soldiers. There would be prison escapes, and finally there would be a dismal electoral campaign, which would ultimately result in Costello's resignation from the IRSP, yet he would continue to pull strings behind the scenes. By autumn of 1977, Costello was demoralised. His party was infighting, the INLA were broke and struggling to find money, and many of the IRSP politicians had left the party when the shadow of the paramilitary INLA became too much to stomach. It was October 5th, 1977, around noon. Costello was in Dublin in his car, ready to attend a Starry Plough meeting, which was the IRSP's monthly magazine editorial, meeting in Upper Gardiner Street. He was waiting in his car under Northbrook Road Bridge and reading the paper. At 1 p.m. he would leave his car and attend the meeting. He'd been doing this for 3 weeks now, and his patterns had been noticed by IRSP member Miriam Reid, who had seen him parked under the bridge. She was amused by his predictable habits, that he would always be at this spot at this time. But she wasn't the only one who noticed. On this day, Costello was being watched by Jim Flynn from South Armagh. Flynn was a quartermaster for the officials, and had a reputation of being almost as dangerous as Joe McCann. And now seeing Costello, here and vulnerable, Flynn began to make his plans. Who knows what was going through Costello's head on this day? Apparently he was depressed, and in the words of one colleague, quote, "All he thought about was guns and money, and how they were going to get them." We can only imagine that by this point, the feud with the officials was a distant memory. On this cold October day, Costello was probably oblivious as Flynn walked up to his car window, wearing an overcoat. It isn't known if the window was already down or if Costello rolled it down, but what happened next was Flynn raised a double-barreled shotgun and fired. Costello was hit in the head and neck, killed instantly. He then fell forward and Flynn put two more shotgun shells in his back, which according to the coroner's report, tore his lungs to shreds. Flynn fled Dublin and ended up in a safe house with a friend in a town near the border. But like all acts of vengeance, this day would cost him dearly. The INLA, never one to leave a fallen comrade unavenged, least of all their leader, would have their moment. 5 years later, Flynn would be shot to death in a hail of bullets by the INLA. And in a bitter twist of irony, he would only die a mile down the road from where he killed Costello. And so that was the end of Seamus Costello, A man who, only 3 years earlier, stood in the hall of the Spa Hotel and declared he was going to agitate against the British war machine and lead Ireland's working classes to a 32-county socialist country. Of his character, his friends said that there had never been a more charismatic leader who could motivate his supporters. To his enemies, he was nothing more than a belligerent sectarian, a man who overplayed his hand, who was overconfident, and thought that because he knew the Republican struggle in the Republic, he knew how to control the men in Belfast and Derry. Some say he created a monster in the INLA and couldn't control it. Yet to others and his supporters, he was the greatest Republican. Even Cathal Goulding, when he heard of Costello's assassination, called Costello's wife and said, "Christ, I am so, so sorry for your loss." And this can be at least some testimony for Costello. It's undeniable that he galvanised the working class in Northern Ireland along socialist lines, which is something that hadn't been seen since the likes of the Easter Rising. At his funeral, former Senator Nora Connolly O'Brien, daughter of the Easter Rising leader James Connolly, gave the oration. She said, "Of all the politicians and political people with whom I have had conversations with and who have called themselves followers of Connolly, he was the only one who truly understood what James Connolly meant when he spoke of his vision of the freedom of the Irish people." So what became of the INLA? After Costello's death, the organisation would enjoy notoriety for their assassinations of Éirí Níve and their attacks on British soldiers, but they would also come under the rule of Dominic "Mad Dog" McGlinchey. They would then be sucked down into what only can be described as a vortex of internal gang warfare, SAS assassinations, criminality, loyalist assassinations, drug busts and supergrasses. By the year 2009, the organisation, although still dangerous, was a shell of its former self. Instead of the INLA leading the people of the North to a working class revolution, it would lead to nothing more than bullets and bombs in Northern Ireland, to bloody assassinations inside of pubs, men being taken out of their homes in front of their wives, never to be seen again, and men being kicked to death in pub car parks, and teenagers being kneecapped in back alleys. It was a far cry from the early days of 1975, when the INLA were making glorious promises. There is a saying that the road to hell is paved with the best of intentions. And perhaps Costello embodied that. That's it for this week. Thanks, and see you next time. This episode was written by John Livingstone. John is a master's graduate in international relations, specialising in the Troubles, and he has been researching this topic heavily for 7 years. If you're interested in anything related to this topic, you can find more of his work on his blog at The Troubles Archive on Instagram. The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or simply telling your friends. It all helps.